Christ. Oy, oy, oy. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw nigh and give your attention. For this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
We'll call the case of Lippman versus Nicholson. It's number 040812. I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Mormon, and to the left is Judge Scholin, who will represent the appellant.
Howie Runner.
And you please identify yourself.
My name is Ari Michelson. I represent the appellant, Mark Lippman.
Thank you. And is there an intervener?
There is, sir. My name is John Howell, and I represent Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Howell. And the secretary?
Thomas Sullivan for the secretary, and Edward Cassidy.
Thank you. Everyone will have 30 minutes to argue. The appellant and intervener may reserve time. You will start. Will you be reserving time?
Yes, Your Honor.
How much would you like to reserve?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. And would you like to reserve time?
Same.
10 and 10. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Again, my name is Ari Michelson, and I'm here representing the appellant, Mark Lippman. As the court is well aware, there are two basic issues here today. The first one is a question of federal versus state law, and federal preemption. And the second is, assuming we get over the preemption part of it, what is the application of the law in this case? Your Honors, I would venture to say that there are a few areas of the law that are more federal in character than the veterans law. This has been recognized by the Supreme Court, it's been recognized by the Federal Circuit, and it's been recognized by this court as well, as I will get into as I go through my argument here today. So it is indeed somewhat surprising that the decision below seem to not even deal with the issue of the fact that there was a federal scheme other than with a few short words. And I'd like to quote for just a moment from the decision below, the record at page 7, where it says, "The Regional Council summarized the pertinent facts regarding this case, noting that contingent fee agreements, such as the contract in this case, and I here emphasize, were contemplated by veterans' benefits law." That is the only mention that decision essentially makes about the application of federal law to veterans' benefits law. And then it goes on right away to say, "In order, however, to analyze the contract with respect to state law, the Regional Council stated that the choice of appropriate state law to apply was critical to the outcome of the legal inquiry." And so it goes directly into essentially assuming that state law applies and then going into the issue of which state law applies. Now, this is somewhat surprising. Given that this decision was well after, for example, the Skates decision, where the Federal Circuit essentially also pointed out, and I'll quote from the Skates decision right at the end, this is at 282 F3rd at 1369, "Here, however, a federal statute provides for and governs the 20% contingent fee arrangement and the Secretary's payment of the fee to the attorney out of the proceeds of the past benefits awarded. In that situation, should not federal rather than state law govern those aspects of the relationship?"
Counselor, to be sure, if I may interrupt.
Yes.
I believe that the Federal Circuit does not go on to answer that question. And earlier in the decision, they do reference the possibility of recovery under state law as a possible factor that might be considered. Is that not correct?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure I would quite characterize it that way. I think the court acknowledges that state law may play a role in the determination of whether or not a fee is reasonable. But I don't think that the decision comes out saying that it doesn't think that federal law applies to the award of benefits. Indeed, if you look at the decision itself, it's essentially until it gets to the end when it actually talks about that aspect of whether or not the reward was reasonable. Before the reasonableness section, there's really no discussion of state law, really, per se, as being applicable, at least in my reading of the case.
Then what role would you believe that state law may have?
Well, there are various aspects of the attorney-client relationship, ethical responsibilities between the two. There may be a state law applicability to determination of what reasonableness is. Your Honor, we don't deny that the veteran is able to challenge the reasonableness of the 20% contingency fee. And to the extent that any kind of color has been attempted to be added to this case to intimate that somehow the 20% fee is automatic regardless, no matter what, under any circumstances whatsoever, really doesn't show a clear reading of appellant's brief, which does make clear that reasonableness is challengeable. While state law may play a role in determining the reasonableness, the notion that under federal veterans law, the 20% contingency fee is a 20% contingency fee doesn't seem to really be questioned. I'd like to just invoke the U.S.
view. If you're suggesting that state law would apply to reasonableness, why wouldn't the state law in this case, which addresses quantum merit, be one of the considerations that the board or the court should consider?
Well, quantum merit might be considerable, and I don't deny that if we're getting into state law grounds where we're considering reasonableness of the award, that state law, such as that of Colorado, which requires certain things be done before quantum merit can actually be considered, I'm not sure how that necessarily would play out, though I don't deny that it's possible that state law may get involved there. But the issue is not whether or not there should be an additional consideration of quantum merit here. The question is whether or not, basically out of hand, the 20% contingency fee should be rejected simply because there was termination under state law, whereas the federal statute makes clear that the 20% fee holds in place so long as there is a remand from the board. That doesn't seem to be where the...
Isn't it only a presumption of 20%?
Well, yes, that's why I say it's...
The board can review it at all times.
Sure. I mean, the 20% is a limit, and it's a limit that was basically set by the federal statutory scheme essentially as a compromise, understanding that veterans need representation and attorneys are willing to take up to something like half of what they normally would in a contingency fee case just in order to make sure that there's a guaranteed payment. And that statutory scheme is fixed under federal law. Whether or not the 20% max that's allowed under federal law actually would turn out to be the case in a particular instance is, of course, subject to court review.
So if you're, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, if you're reviewing the performance of the attorney for whether or not 20% is itself reasonable, rebutting a presumption, if you will, would you look to state law?
In reasonableness, it's possible that one would look to state law.
Isn't that the issue here?
No, Your Honor. The issue here is whether or not it's cut off at the pass. Here, by saying that state law controls whether or not the award is available, period, in principle, available.
Well, just reverse the logic then. If they say you can get up to 20% under federal law, but we're going to review the reasonableness, and under Colorado law, it's not reasonable because the quantum merit was not stated in the contract, you'd end up with the same result we have here, wouldn't you?
Well, for quantum merit, perhaps, but not for the extent of the amount of the 20% that would necessarily be awardable if that pot of money was made available to begin with and not simply cut off at the pass, right? Because you can talk about the reasonableness about whether or not the 20% fee was available, and that's separate from saying that there's a separate clause in the state law that says... if you terminate before the agreement, you don't get anything. That's not a question of reasonableness. That's a question of entitlement, and the question of entitlement is the one that's prescribed under federal law and requires a maximum of 20%.
Where in federal law it describes what to do in the situation where a fee contract is terminated prior to the award of benefits?
That's not explicitly... it is explicitly dealt with, actually, because the statute itself points out, the regulation, 38 CFR section 2609H, payment awarded as a result of successful appeal to the Board of Veterans' Appeals or an appellate court. And so that regulation is part of the regulatory scheme that essentially makes clear that the 38 U.S.C. 5904 section governing the 20% contingency fee is to be awarded pursuant to administrative regulation as a result of a successful appeal to the Board of Veterans' Appeals or to this court.
In light of the actual terms of the contract in this case, though, the fee for services at the court was pro bono and potentially limited to EJA fees. So does the term of the contract override the terms of the regulation?
The actions before this court are, I think, separable, Your Honor, and I understand the clause that you're referring to in the fee agreement. But I think we can read that clause as basically saying, I'm going to represent you before this court pro bono. I'll write the papers necessary. Anything that happens as far as fee goes is going to be what happens subsequently to that. Subsequently, upon the remand, then 20.609 comes into play. So I don't think the contract needs to be read as trumping that regulation, no.
Upon board remand or upon court remand?
Excuse me, upon court remand, Your Honor.
Is court remand always, does that always fulfill the definition of successful appeal at the CAVC?
I would say so, Your Honor. A remand would be a victory for the appellant. Would it
what
not?
If the appellant takes a position that it's not a victory for the appellant? I.e., in this case, didn't the attorney oppose the appellee's motion for remand?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I think that had the appellant not opposed that motion, the charge would have been leveled perhaps even more forcefully the other way, because the client could have come screaming, you know, you didn't move to oppose, and therefore we're not going to be able to get EAGA fees, and therefore I'm going to have to pay more proceeds out of my pot than I otherwise would have. So Mr. Lippman was in a situation where, you know, the way it turns out, he's kind of cooked if he did or if he didn't. I don't think, Your Honor, that if you, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought for just a moment.
Successful on appeal.
Yes. So I don't think that if the claimant was successful on appeal, that would be not a victory. It would have been more of a victory, obviously, if EAGA award was possible. But that doesn't take away from the fact that upon remand, that led ultimately to benefits that were awarded to the veteran and therefore was a victory to the veteran. There would have been a greater victory, obviously, if EAGA would have been able to be considered.
But just to clarify the contract, which is in the record, 174.
Yes.
As I understood the contract, getting a remand at a minimum would permit the follow-on steps to take place, and this contract and any fees are dependent on the representation and an award following that remand. Success at the court is pro bono and not tied into the fees at all, except by virtue of the fact that the process began below. And in that process below, the attorney and the client agreed that the attorney would represent him in the proceedings below, and then if there's an award below, be success.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the contract language says, and this is record at page 175, third line of under item 3, on the basis of the client's claim following a remand order from the United States Court of Veterans Appeal.
And not in connection with the pro bono appeal to the U.S. Court of Veterans Appeals. So, yes, you needed something favorable from this court to keep the proceedings going, but whatever happened, whatever work was done in this court is not part of this agreement to which fee would be paid. The fees come from the result of the claim below and the paragraph before, scope and duties, that the attorney would continue to represent him during that proceeding below.
On the basis of the claim following a remand order, meaning that the ultimate award of fee would be gained from whatever came as a result of the basis of the proceedings.
Well, I think you're ignoring two then. Paragraph two is scope and duties.
Your Honor, it's true that the scope and duties contemplates further work by the attorney.
And the only award that the attorney can take is for the further duties, because the representation at the court is pro bono.
Well, the only award that the attorney can get is based on the outcome of the proceedings following. I'm not sure that necessarily precludes there being no award on the basis.
So if the attorney walked away after a remand?
If the attorney walked away without good cause, obviously there would not be reasonableness. If the attorney walked away with good cause, or if the attorney was terminated without good cause, without good faith by the client, under those circumstances, the reasonableness analysis might differ, Your Honor. Right?
Well, assuming he even had good cause to walk away.
Well, again, if he had good cause to walk away, there had been, as a result of his efforts, a remand, then there was still going to be some basis for the award based on the fact that a remand had occurred.
And that wouldn't be because of the pro bono appeal to the U.S. What does this mean, then? And not in connection with the pro bono appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals. This is written by the attorney, is it not?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
All right. Well, that paragraph strikes out and screams to seem to say that no, I am going to represent you pro bono at the court. I get nothing for that. Now, when it's remanded, I will get something, but when it's remanded, I'm going to represent you.
It's true that after remand, there is contemplated additional representation, Your Honor. But I would argue that the remand itself was a successful outcome, the basis of which would form the underlying calculus.
Accepting that, there would be a 20% award, presumed to be reasonable. If the board were to review that for reasonableness, would they consider state law? And if state law said you can't get anything quantum merit if you leave, you don't get anything, would that be not a consideration that board would take into consideration?
Well,
that factor the board would take
again,
into consideration.
I would separate entitlement from reasonableness. And if the state law provision is one that cuts it off at the pass and says that there's no entitlement without even a consideration of reasonableness, I would say that that would be trumped by the federal statute. I'd further say that Mr. Lippman has been doing these veterans appeals for a long time, and these types of agreements with clients are fairly standardly drafted to, as far as I understand it, conform to the scheme set forth in
the federal law. Doesn't say you can't represent pro bono up here at the court. So, I mean, it just because it says it doesn't mean, and just because it's been approved in the past doesn't mean it's not reasonable. But you tell me what it means. Not in connection with the pro bono appeal to the U.S. Court of Veterans Appeals. Doesn't that take whatever work was done for the court off the table?
I'm not sure that is completely fleshed out in the record, Your Honor, and I think
well,
that
what
that
does it mean? You're representing your client who wrote this. What does it mean?
As I said, I think that the pro bono part of it, in terms of putting together papers in preparation for the appeal, is done pro bono, but the expectation is that after remand, a reward is still due based on the ultimate outcome
of
the case.
All right, let me rephrase it. On remand, if this were to be remanded for a consideration of reasonableness, should the board consider any work that was done in this court?
I wouldn't foreclose that possibility, Your Honor, because fundamentally, by articulating the position the way I just did, by saying that the remand itself essentially snaps into action an entitlement to the award, would still allow one to consider that.
But if the 20% were being attacked for reasonableness, given the contract, given the phrase we just talked about, not in connection with the pro bono appeal to the U.S. Court of Veterans Appeals, if the board were to consider reasonableness, not statutorily precluded, state law, forget it for a second, they're just going to consider reasonableness, would they consider any of the work done in court?
They may or may not. The point is that
in accordance with this contract on page 2, given that phrase, should they consider any of the work?
They should certainly consider it, whether or not they would find it.
What does that phrase mean, then?
Well, again, Your Honor, I say that the work done pro bono does not preclude recovery following a remand, because once the remand occurs,
no, he can have a recovery. I want to make sure we're on the same sheet. He can have a recovery. He can have up to 20%. The veteran comes in and says, wait a minute, I think the 20%, given how this thing turned out, is not reasonable. Okay. When the board assesses reasonableness, given this agreement written by the attorney in that phrase, should the board consider the work done at this court in getting the remand, or only the work done subsequent to the remand?
The court should consider all the facts once, upon remand, it has gotten over the hump of not using state law to control.
And what is that I just want to know what that phrase means.
He's not going to ask for any payment until after the remand occurs.
Well, it says, and not in connection. Following a remand order from the United States Court of Appeals, and not in connection with the pro bono appeal. I mean, doesn't that take it all off the table? I'm pro bono in the court. If we win at the court, I'm going to represent you down below. And what I do below, I get 20%. Or you get 20%, period. But now the veteran comes in and says, I'm questioning what he did below. And my question is, what does that phrase mean? That's what I'm trying to figure out. And since you, or your client, wrote it, you get first say. And you have 43 seconds to do it. if you have any questions, I'm sorry. We can extend this a little bit. I'm just trying to hammer that down.
No, that answers my question.
Okay.